Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of The Film Stage Show, the official podcast of thefilmstage.com. I am your host, Brian J. Rowan. With me, as always, passengers on this cinematic journey, there's Nick Newman, associate editor for The Film Stage.
Hello.
And Danny King, writer for The Film Stage.
Hi, Brian.
Hello. And today, to help us talk about the newest Liam Neeson thriller, Nonstop, we have Ty Landis from In Review Online and the movie Mezzanine.
Hi guys, thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining us.
No problem.
So it's been a couple weeks since we talked to you all. Apologies for that, but really there wasn't a lot that was coming out that we wanted to talk about it, and we were busy. So sorry, but we're back today to talk about the newest Liam Neeson thriller, Nonstop. This directed by. Did we ever figure out how to say this name?
Albert Serra?
No, not quite.
Different filmmaker, actually.
I'm going to take a stab.
Your usual pronunciation guy.
Clear the room. I'm going to guess that it's Ame Cole Serra.
Okay. We'll stick with that. So, directed by Ame Cole Serra. I really am sorry if we're saying that wrong.
Yeah, no, no.
There should be a database.
Let's make that clear.
Where we can go to figure this out. But yeah, this is their second. What should I call this? I want to call it a
collaboration.
Collaboration. Yeah, I kept wanting to say commiseration. That's not right at all. After Unknown from 2011, which I forgot that I saw, but when I remembered I saw it, I remembered that I kind of liked it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So we'll be talking about that. Before we get into that and our discussion for the day, I'd like to say to everyone, thank you for adding some more ratings to our iTunes page. Feel free to go and do some more of that. Let us know how we're doing. Leave us a comment. You can also comment on the post for this podcast on thefilmstage.com. And you can email us at podcast@thefilmstage.com if you so desire. Before we get into a review of Nonstop, however, some sad news that we all woke up to today. It is currently like 9 o'clock on Sunday morning, and upon waking up, I checked Twitter, and the news was just sort of rolling out that Alain René, the director of one of my favorite movies of all time, Last Year at Marienbad, along with a scores of other important historic films had passed away at the age of 91. So we wanted to take a quick moment to talk about our relationship to him and his films, and to just express our gratitude for his work and our condolences for everyone who is feeling this loss today. So Nick Newman, why don't you start us off?
Yeah, I woke up at 8:45, so I just found out this news, and it was, unfortunately, as it so often happens now today, I found out through Twitter. I just opened TweetDeck, and I saw, maybe I can even just scroll back a bit. Yeah, I saw a bunch of people tweeting about René, and I just sort of got this like sick feeling in my stomach, because I just thought, oh, no. And sure enough, it was confirmed. I mean, you know, it's funny, the passing of a 91-year-old man who had done some of the best work the medium has ever seen. I suppose something about it shouldn't really feel that sad, just because I never met the man, and I doubt he ever knew of my existence. And you know, I mean, I only know him through his films, many of which I've still have yet to see, and the ones I have seen have been pretty much uniformly terrific. Despite all that, I'm just very saddened by the news. I feel like, you know, this is a man who had just premiered one last film at Berlin in February, and the movie is still yet to be released. I just wrote up a news post about the trailer for it a few weeks ago, And it seemed as if he was, I don't believe he was actually there, so I'm not sure if that was indicative of his health or anything like that, but more to the point about just sort of films of his I've seen, his most recently released film is You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, which came out in the U.S. in the summer of 2013, and that was number 5 on my top 10 of the year. It's an incredible film that is sort of a cliche, but it feels like it was made by someone, you know, not even half his age. That could be the last that I could see that, you know, in a theatrical setting and whatnot. Not so long before his passing, I suppose, is kind of nice. It's a nice little denouement of sorts, but there's still so many of his films to discover. And that was a theatrical first run experience, the last one I had, because Danny and I just a couple of weeks ago saw his film Je T'aime, Je T'aime at Film Forum. There was just a print of it that was recently revived, and it was priority viewing. I made sure I got up early to go into the city to see this film. That's how much I cared about it, even having never seen it before. And it was a great experience. And it's weird. It's not a surprise, really. I can't honestly say it's a surprise that he's passed, because again, he was 91 years old. But
yeah,
I'm still saddened by it, because there's much of his cinema to discover, and I've been discovering it, and it's been an incredible experience. I mean, there are, of course, the staples such as Last Year at Marion Bad or Hiroshima Mon Amour, Night and Fog, but then there's also the likes of Muriel or The Time of Return. There's a film of his called The War is Over, which is terrific, which I saw recently. There's also, more recently, Wild Grass from 2009, which is an incredible film. And is actually, like You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, is a wonderful film about aging and sort of accepting the natural order of things, I think. And so for that to be one of his last films is appropriate, I think. I'm very shocked by the news. Maybe not, again, not so much shocked, just as I am a bit defeated by it. He's one of the best voices that the medium has ever seen, and certainly among the very best filmmakers who were still working today. So regardless of anything else, I think this is just a terrible loss.
All right.
So that's that.
Ty Landis, what about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, admittedly, I don't have that great of a relationship with the films of him. I've only seen 4 of them, and I think 2 of them, Hiroshima Mon Amour and Last Year Marion Bed, many years ago when I was dumb and didn't know what I was talking about and was still trying to form sort of my identity with films and what I was accustomed to liking and such. I think Nick kind of nailed it, and just echoing how with Wild Grass and You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet, which I'm still kind of, I admire the film greatly, but it wasn't something that I was fully able to connect with. But you get the sense that there's this sort of lasting fluidity and presence within his films. And Nick touched upon it with, you know, A Man in the Autumn of His Life, and those, you know, shine through greatly in those 2 films. But yeah, I mean, it's weird for me. Like I can't put my finger on it, just because there's so much of his stuff that I still have left to explore. And I'm getting the sense that through all of his stuff, he's such a singular filmmaker. So it's even going to make, you know, revisiting everything such a much more richer experience, but obviously a huge loss indeed.
Danny King.
Yeah, I have to kind of repeat what's already been said. I know that, you know, Nick, when we were talking about Je T'aime, Je T'aime after we saw it, we were kind of, I mean, obviously the first movie you think of after you watch Je T'aime, Je T'aime is Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is kind of like a sort of like a generational touchstone film. And
yeah,
Je T'aime, Je T'aime hadn't really been widely seen for a while. So you just kind of think to yourself, like, okay, if this Renée film that like no one has seen for years influenced a movie as popular as Eternal Sunshine, and like what other riches must be in store in that filmography, because I'm sure there's like just an endless amount of them. And I look forward to discovering them. I think like just in terms of the stuff I've seen, like the canonical stuff we've mentioned, and also You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet. It just seems like time is sort of a consistent theme there, and he's he kind of explores that not just in content but in form and just like with some really radical editing. And so, yeah, I mean, I just like have so much left to see that I'm not really, I don't want to just like sum up what he meant to film, but it obviously like he's a giant name, and like, yeah, I don't know if his death has like hit me as on like a shock level, like Nick mentioned, just because he is like kind of on in years and he has so much behind him, but like definitely a sort of jarring thing to wake up to.
Yeah, not exactly how you want to begin your Sunday.
Yeah, pretty early Sunday, too.
Very early Sunday, Danny. I guess I'll just say, Danny is the reason that we all had to wake up at like 8:45, 9 o'clock, too.
Yeah, I want to go see Nonstop again right after. So.
I guess, yeah, I'll second what everyone else has said. I mean, the thing is, and this is a sensation that I'm unfortunately very familiar with. Sometimes someone's death can shock you without surprising you. In this case, I mean, I remember when Nick was talking about having put You Ain't Seen Nothing Yet on his list for the year, and I was just thinking, like, how many more movies do we have from Alain René? And unfortunately, that's been answered now. You know, age is a reliable indicator of longevity, unfortunately. But at the same time, it's still just difficult because, for me especially, when I was in... I mean, I was into film in a large and thoughtful way in high school. But I think that I still count my first viewing of Last Year at Marienbad as one of the more formative moments in my film life. Especially because I saw it in a college course, and I was literally the only person in my class who liked the film. And this was a film class, so obviously everyone there should have been prepared for something a little more than Nonstop. But it's also the film that I wrote my dissertation for that class on, and I actually had to fight the TA to give me 5 more pages in my paper, bumping it up to 15 so that I'd be able to most fully explicate my feelings on the movie and its place within the French New Wave. So, yeah. this is a big, terrible moment. But the kind of thing that I take a little bit of solace in is just looking over his filmography, the sheer volume that he created and produced. There's a lot to go over. Which, unlike someone like Philip Seymour Hoffman, where you kind of wonder what else he could have done, same with Heath Ledger, this feels a little more complete. You have a full life of creation and art to go back on, and so there's a little bit of solace there, but yeah, it's still a huge loss for the world of film, and it's happening on the night of the Oscars, so I don't know if I'm supposed to take anything from that, but it's one of those strange things that you just kind of attach a meaning to because it's there.
So cinema is being adversely affected in multiple ways today.
Boom.
Yes.
That's exactly true. Yeah, I was gonna say that we should talk about the Oscars a bit to open up this episode, but I think this is a much more worthy thing. And I guess we'll give our brief feelings on the Oscars next week, probably. You know, but I'm sure that it'll, unless there's like a really great surprise at the end of the night at the Oscars, like the people who actually deserve to win, I don't want to talk about it.
Or if Crash wins again.
If Crash wins again? You mean American Hustle?
Yes.
This year's Crash?
Bring up Paul Haggis to accept this Oscar, please.
Oh, God. All right. Well, we've had some heavy conversation thus far. So let's lighten it up a bit. Let's talk about our feature review, which is of the movie Nonstop, starring Liam Neeson and a number of people, actually. Shea Whigham makes an appearance. Everybody here loves Shea Whigham. We also have Best Supporting Actress nominee, Lupita Nyong'o, which was really weird. It took me a second to realize.
Wait. That wasn't Grace Jones?
That wasn't Grace Jones.
It is the best haircut ever.
It really does look like with the flight attendant outfit. It looks like if Grace Jones was on an episode of Star Trek. That's kind of what I was thinking. That has to be a conscious decision. Like nobody goes like if you were a black woman and you get that haircut, like Grace Jones. Like realistically, I don't know. It's just something that was on my mind the entire time. I was thinking of A View to a Kill.
Yeah.
Perhaps the worst Bond movie.
Yeah, that was Dalton, wasn't it?
No, that was the last Roger Moore one when he was like 60 or something.
Jesus.
And he's still betting young women. Yeah, with Christopher Walken as Max Zorin. Anyway. Alain Resnais just died, and I'm talking about A View to a Kill, and we're about to review nonstop. So let's...
It's a very surreal day. I mean, let's not deny that.
let's proceed.
Also, Julianne Moore and Scoot McNairy, our boy Scoot, who's always a pleasure to see. So, Nonstop, directed by... Yame Colesera. Is that what we agreed on? Yame?
Let's go.
Sure.
Jaume?
Yeah, maybe we should do a few different ones throughout the show. It's like,
yeah, let's just keep calling it a different thing. Directed by Yame Colesera.
Someone on this flight is threatening to kill someone every 20 minutes unless $150 million is transferred to this account number.
We're midway across the Atlantic. How do you kill someone in a crowded plane and get away with it?
Ladies and gentlemen, we need every passenger to raise their hands above their head.
This is a bad idea.
Marshal! We have a right to know what the hell is
going on! Agent Marks, the account number you gave us is in your name.
What? That doesn't make any sense. This is a setup. Something else is going on.
So Nonstop is the story of Federal Air Marshal Bill Marks, played by Liam Neeson. And he's on a transatlantic flight from, I believe, New York to London, when he receives a series of text messages saying that someone is on the plane, is going to kill a passenger every 20 minutes unless they get $150 million. Twists and turns abound, and it appears as though this madman is trying to set up Bill to take the fall. Nonstop. Let's talk about it, guys. What did we think of the movie Nonstop? Ty Landis, you were the guest. You were here specifically for this film.
Yeah, and I haven't... I didn't get the chance to revisit the extensive catalog of Mr. Sarah. I missed out on, is it Goal 2 or Goal 3? And
Goal 2, Living Your Dream.
Goal 2, yeah, and House of Wax, but I was able to catch up with his other films. But admittedly, I had a few drinks to me when I viewed this, so I was a little skeptical that I'd be fully engaged and in tune with this beast of a film. But yeah, I think I think it's fine. I think it's agreeable as an early year action thriller. I'm not quite, I know there's a small faction that are like really quite enthusiastic about it, but I think it's probably a step below being really solid for me. I think it works best as a procedural before it gets into, the revealing of the villain/villains, but the sort of shifting and evolving grasp of information and identity in the this very claustrophobic setting that the film takes place in. But and I think it's hard to sustain, it's a fluid pacing and, rhythm, given the pretty much the entire film takes place on the plane. So kudos for that. But we'll get to it later, obviously, but is the reveal a little bit underwhelming? Sure. But by that point, I think the movie had done just enough for me. Aesthetically, of course, the camera seems to dance around rather gracefully, and the performances are on point, especially with the strong supporting cast. So I don't think it's great. I would have liked a little more action and maybe fluidity in the way the action was shot. But obviously, for what it sets out to do, it's a fine, entertaining, and engaging film. And with the three films I've seen from Sarah, there's this sense of sort of grounded professionalism behind the camera amid the the kind of chaotic and ridiculous narratives that his films take on, but which is something I admire, and you don't see that too much. But yeah, I think it's a fine movie. I'm not crazy about it in any way, but I think it's fine.
All right, Nick Newman.
So I am surprised at how much I like this film. I went into it kind of expecting. I would say I sort of got what I was expecting. Begin with, in a certain sense, but I also, because I think that, you know, the idea of like a Liam Neeson thriller, and sort of in particular one that's released at the beginning stages of the year, you kind of have certain preconceptions, which I think the movies themselves are sort of built on. And, you know, Nonstop delivered on those, but I actually kind of found a bit more going on here. I mean, I don't know if it's a very complex or deep film. I don't know if it's an especially riveting character study, but just in terms of Colesero's work here, I found it to be hugely engaging, just on a formal level. The way this film is composed was just kind of a joy to take in. What feels like a pretty, by and large, a rejection of typical, you know, shot reverse shots techniques, and sort of maintaining this very strange rhythm with these off-kilter compositions and various screen superimpositions that were quite entertaining. I guess maybe one of the more obvious comparisons would be like House of Cards, for instance, with the text messages that come on the screen.
Sherlock does the same thing.
Oh, that's right, yes. It's gimmicky, but I think actually more than those two shows, this is actually doing things with the central image on the screen, and is kind of maintaining this certain dynamism, which I don't know. I guess that alone was just kind of fun to take in. But on top of that, it's you know, the film is pretty dumb, but I think that it manages to be dumb without actually insulting its audience's intelligence. I think that it's aware. I think more than anything, it's aware that audiences will go along with this sort of thing than it is demanding that an audience be accepting of this absurdity.
You don't walk into a movie that's been marketed this way and has Liam Neeson in it, and I mean, like, I feel like absurdity is part of the game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't think anyone walked in expecting it to not be absurd.
Yeah, but it's a fun absurd.
Yeah, it's definitely a fun absurd.
And
you've got to be like on that level, and I think that's why it actually is doing so well this weekend, because it's been a while since we've had something that was kind of trying to hit this tone.
Mm. Yeah, no. I think that's exactly it. It's just playing to audience expectations, but just on kind of a moment-by-moment basis, I was surprised at how much I was relatively engaged with it. Rarely did I actually kind of... With a lot of these films, you know, when they're sort of setting up all these different threads and they're kind of trying to goad you along, I can kind of drop out, because I find that's... There's sort of the sense that I'm just sort of being treated like, you know, like a circus animal with a carrot dangling in front of me or something. This, not so much. I found that sort of its minute-by-minute progression was very well handled. And although it kind of gets a bit fuzzy in terms of chronology, like, because he's supposed to kill someone every 20 minutes, but it's a, you know, something like a 6-hour flight. So that doesn't really make a lot of sense. And the movie doesn't really care. Like, initially it kind of plays up the idea of like a real time, a real time system. And then it just kind of says, fuck it. I really just had a lot of fun with it. And on top of that, I mean, you know, there's the idea of, well, are you really asking for much else? And maybe not, but I found it, again, I just found it engaging minute by minute, and Neeson is good, although I do think, I am starting to wonder if maybe he's kind of doing these parts with a wink and a nod, because there is a scene, it's strange, because there is a scene sort of toward the end of this movie where he makes like a confession to the people in the airplane.
Oh man, that confession. Mm-hmm.
And it's so ridiculous, and it plays just like the way it plays out. I mean, it's on paper, maybe it seems like it could be sort of powerful. In execution, it's sort of laughable, which is weird because...
That's weird, because I think on paper it's laughable, and that he actually gives it whatever it has.
Okay.
Do you really think that there was an actor who could have pulled that off better?
Like yeah, maybe, I don't know.
Christian Bale type of intensity.
Maybe. I mean, I'm not sure. I just, I was thinking, you know, I was thinking how it's the sort of thing where if this was maybe a more traditional, or what was once a traditional Liam Neeson movie, it would play differently. But regardless, Nonstop, I think, is a lot of fun. And yeah, I mean, it's kind of more than you would. More than you would anticipate from this sort of thing, depending on how excited you are, of course.
Yeah.
I was looking forward to it, relatively speaking, and I got something that I thought was actually quite good. So, yeah, thumbs up to the Neeson picture.
All right, Danny King.
Yeah, I'm also thumbs up on this one. Like Ty, I still have a few films of this director to catch up with, and I'm really looking forward to that. One word on Gull 2 very quickly. In Nick Pinkerton's Bombast column this week, I haven't read through the whole thing yet, but he has a sentence where he says, also directed a movie called Gull 2, Living the Dream, which I'm fairly certain not a single American has ever seen. So maybe that one is like some kind of hidden gem that we all have to discover for ourselves. But
well, that's weird, because I actually remember hearing about the movie Goal, The Dream Begins.
Okay, yeah, and I don't know like what the relation is.
Yeah, and so it's weird, like is there like the Goal 3, like the dream turns into a nightmare, and then like a Goal 4 waking up to reality or something.
I just think only two goals were scored.
Oh, okay, well that's not, that's yeah. A soccer game for you. All right. Anyway, Danny.
Yeah.
Thoughts.
So yeah, Nonstop. Yeah, I liked it quite a bit. One thing I was like thinking about going in, because I didn't see like Taken 2. So I think maybe the first like quote like Liam Neeson revenge movie I saw, at least in terms of how it was marketed, would have been The Gray. It's not really that sort of movie, but like I was thinking about The Gray and you know like how flawed or how vulnerable they make that character. And so going into this movie, I was like, okay, is he going to just be like this sort of kind of like amazing air marshal guy, or is he going to be flawed? And so the movie opens with a shot of his windshield. And then a rack focuses to him behind the rain. And then the second shot is him pouring whiskey in slow motion. And right when that happened, I was just like so behind this movie, because I'm like, all right, they're really gonna like make this guy like a terrible marshal. And so the first 10 minutes are like just these shots where the focus is all out of whack and he's like trying to profile people, but he's just like quite drunk.
I was about to say, just a little too drunk.
Yeah, that's clear. It's clear that like the lack of focus is because of his drunkenness. But so that like really hooked me right away, like how they're just bringing this guy down. He's like smoking on the flight, which was awesome. And so I like that aspect of it. And then, I mean, the other thing that's really fun about the movie is just the cast of actors. In some parts it was weird because like, obviously with Lupita Nyong'o, like she only has two lines in this movie or something. So it must have been made before anyone had an idea that she'd kind of break out right when this movie was being released. And then also Scoot McNairy, he comes up to Liam Neeson in the beginning of the movie and like asks him for a line. And like what happens, I'm like, okay, Scoot McNairy is going to be like a really important character in this movie. And like, I don't know if the movie wanted me to think that way or not. Which was sort of, that kind of threw me off. But I mean, once you get on the flight, you have people like Corey Stoll, and then Nate Parker, who we all, I think, Arbitrage.
Yeah, we loved him in Arbitrage.
Yeah, and then, you know, Shea Whigham. So, I mean, if you gave this movie to a director who didn't really appreciate actors this way, the movie wouldn't be as or as good. But you can tell that Colette Sarah, like, he's really interested in giving every actor their moment. And they all create, you know, fun little characters and keep the movie going. So it definitely falls apart with the reveal. We can get into that. I was pretty into the wife.
Yeah, I gotta agree about the okay, so I guess in general I'm positive on this movie. I quite enjoyed myself. It might be a little, I don't like using the term it's too long, but I think that it gets a little draggy towards the middle portion. But I mean, it's one of those things where the premise itself doesn't seem like it should sustain an entire movie. But as we've already said, through the actors, through the direction, the movie actually does move quite buoyantly for quite a long time. And the twists are never too outlandish. And I wouldn't say it's fiendishly clever, but it is clever enough to keep me guessing and to have kept me engaged. I think that the final twist, the reveal of the forces behind this and their motivation, is a little weird. We could talk about it in spoilers, but the stated purpose for this operation, if you can call it that, is a little bananas. And it takes the movie to a weird place that it had never moved in any direction towards. I felt like kind of wanting to say, like, something along the lines of, you got your Fahrenheit 9/11 in my Taken. But, you know, other than that, it worked really well. We've already talked about how great everyone is. I'll add another name on. Michelle Dockery. She plays Nancy, one of the flight attendants.
Oh, yeah.
The typical sort of damsel in distress-ish type person, but she pulls it off very well and actually makes it believable, and you can empathize with her and her terror at what's going on. So that's great. Whoever plays the co-pilot also does a very good job. And then there's Julianne Moore, who I had a real hard time getting a read on in this film.
Yeah, she's pretty strange.
She's a space case, but I kind of loved it. Like,
yeah.
You've seen characters like her so much, and for her to put that weird, almost like manic pixie dream girl spin on it, it was really, really captivating. So good work, Julianne Moore, because that's crazy. There's also a playfulness to the film. In those establishing shots, we see an Arab-looking gentleman who we later find out is like a neurosurgeon. But everyone on the plane is kind of like glancing at him nervously, which is an uncomfortable truth about our society that the movie does a good job of touching on, but not really overstating. And then beyond that, I wanted to bring up just like we said, it's on an airplane. How interesting could it be? But there's a scene, and I'm sure that there's computer augmentation to this. Actually, I think there has to be, because I think it goes outside of the plane at some point. But the camera moves around fluidly in a long take. And it's one of those long takes where you don't even realize that it's going on until you're about halfway through it. And I was actually really impressed with that, because that's not the type of thing that this movie has to do. And I feel like there was a real clear intention of trying to make this film the best that it could be, and I think that they did it. And so, yeah, I was entertained, I was gripped, and towards the end, I was at the edge of my seat, rooting for this character, Bill Marks, to win the day.
Great name, for
yeah,
him.
Bill Marks. I was like, his first name's Bill, and I was like, his last name's Marks, But then towards the end of the movie, I was like, all right, I can get behind this. As far as my own knowledge of Kole Sara, I've obviously seen Nonstop now. I have seen House of Wax. I was drunk at the time.
What are your memories?
I remember...
Wax.
Wax, yeah. I remember really shitty reveal about some stuff. I also remember that it was just a very... a gruesomely violent film. I think someone got a pole thrown through their head, like javelin style. I also remember not really caring when any of the characters died, because they were all shitty people. So, I do remember that it looked really good. Something that this movie keeps up. I also saw Unknown, as I said at the top, And yeah, I remember enjoying that as well. That was one of those movies that had a real twisty labyrinthine plot, and I think that it pulled it off well. So, oddly enough, everyone weirdly positive on Nonstop. So yeah, the only thing to do now, I suppose, is to talk about the twist and get into the spoilers. So if you haven't seen Nonstop, stop what you're doing and go and see it. if you have seen it and you want to know what we thought about the final reveals, stay tuned. Here we go. So there are two characters who help in various ways during the course of this. Liam Neeson as Bill Marks is having trouble keeping the passengers in line. Everyone's getting nervous. The news on the ground that is coming to the plane through the wonders of technology and the TVs in the back of everyone's seats is saying that he is the hijacker, because honestly, he has not done a great job of convincing anyone that he's not. he makes a lot of bad choices. And it comes out that Scoot McNairy, who had previously been helpful, and Nate Parker's character, who had previously just gotten in the way a lot until finally becoming helpful at some point, were actually the hijackers. And here's the thing. So they had been asking for $150 million, and here we have the kind of The Rock scenario, if anyone remembers The Rock with Nicolas Cage and Sean Connery.
Good movie.
Where, thank you, Danny. I'm glad you agree.
Well, well done.
Very well done. It's in the Criterion Collection, actually. So in The Rock, there's a point where, like, they're doing it for a good reason, but they also want money, and that becomes a schism between the soldiers who've taken over Alcatraz. And there's a similar dynamic here. So Nate Parker and Scoot McNairy, obviously they want the $150 million. Nate Parker does, most of all, and he believes that they will get off. Scoot McNairy, meanwhile, is like a suicidal guy. He's like, you know, we were never gonna get off this plane. And his explanation for what the hell they are doing is bananas. Can someone even try to explain to me what the overall objective of this was in his eyes?
I can attempt.
Okay, I would love that, because I live in Washington, D.C. Can't ever say that enough. I see a lot of crazy people handing out pamphlets, and he sounded like most of them. So, Nick Newman, could you try to explain to us the purpose of Scoot McNairy's plan and his siblings?
Okay. So, his father... Okay, I have to say, before I go into it, I really like the twist in this film because it is so shameless. And
it is
using terrible events to just make for a stupid twist, and I love that. I think that's terrific. Okay, so Scoot McNairy's character, his father died in 9/11, right?
Yes, I got that. That was clear.
Yes,
and they never say 9/11 though.
What?
Come on. You say it's shameless. I'm saying he didn't say. Died in 9/11.
I think not saying 9/11 is actually in some way worse by saying 3,000 people died on that day. Okay, yeah. So
what day could that be?
His father died on 9/11,
yes.
And as a result, he went to fight in the Iraq War,
right,
or Afghanistan, either or, probably Iraq, and feeling disillusioned by. Just feeling disillusioned by a directionless campaign and a nation that had not treated him well upon returning from said campaign, he felt that there needed to be a change in American society. So to increase airport security, he decides to blow up a plane containing 150 people, essentially because there's a line which goes something like, you can't change the world in words unless they're written in blood in the evening news.
Yeah, that was an awesome line. I think it was, words don't change the world unless blah, blah,
okay.
blah. Because that was after Liam Neeson has the killer line, you should have just written a pamphlet.
Yeah.
Which I heard and literally cheered. So it really is just like breaking into someone's house to convince them to get ADT.
Yeah, basically. It's very, I mean, it's well, quite stupid, but yeah. The thing is, it's stupid and it's shameless, and I think that's kind of great, because it is so much better than some, you know, like, garbage, like, extremely loud and incredibly close, which decides to be cloying about 9/11 and try to, you know, try to make you feel all the feels because of...
if that little kid had just hijacked an airplane.
This, to me, is so much better, and that, I mean, you know... I can't really defend it, which is why I like it more, honestly. And also kind of how, you know, at the end of the movie, it sort of doesn't even matter that this is the reason. It just turns into, you know, we landed in Iceland, so let's go have fun, Julianne Moore.
Yeah.
You know, not sort of facing that this is the result of a still emotionally traumatized nation. It's just kind of like, let's just go have some fun.
It's like a feeling that nothing has really changed. It's like, I mean, this madman is trying to frame him. There are still like three dead people.
You know,
everyone's just like, hey, it's over.
You know that, I mean, you know, Martin Scorsese has said, cinema is as much a matter of what's outside the frame as what's in. Yes. So I think this movie is really abiding by that principle.
Mm-hmm.
Not going through all the legislative actions which will be taken. Well, and the thing is, I'm sure airport security will be better, but people didn't have to die. It's truly a happy ending.
It is. Oh, my God. Okay, so here's another thing, though. At some point, Scoot McNairy's, like, in the middle of his crazy speech, which I only remember in, like, disjointed phrases that he screams. And one of them, because I usually in a movie, I'm pretty good at reconstructing, like, particular speeches and stuff. I can't do that with this one. But there's a point where he screams, "Do you have any idea how easy this was?" And I'm like, "Bullshit! Are you kidding me? There's no way this could have been easy for you." He had to have like a little blowgun. He had to perfect pickpocketing skills. He had to do all the recon on the two air marshals that are on the plane. Like,
he had to buy a ticket for the flight.
He had to go to get the ticket. He had to take his shoes off in the line. I mean. There's just, he says that, and I'm like, nonsense. Because you had to hack into the secure network for the texting thing. I mean, bananas. Like, you had to get a bomb into a kilo of cocaine. Like, how did you do that? Oh my God. But all the same, yeah, I still enjoyed the movie. But that twist when he just starts spouting off, like, all of that stuff, I was a little blown away at first.
I mean, just real quick with his character, I mean, I feel like obviously the average film goer isn't going to recognize him from you know, from anyone else. So, like, when he first popped up, didn't I just like tip you guys off that, okay,
yeah,
it's like, what was the Ebert rule about villains in a movie? Or
oh yeah, it was like,
I don't know if that really, it doesn't really apply to this because McNary's not like a huge supporting actor, you know, leading guy, but I just felt, but the great thing is, when the film goes on, you sort of lose track that he's, not that he's in it, because he doesn't, like, leave the, you know, he, I don't think he leaves the film for an extended period of time, obviously, but you just kind of go along and you forget that he's presented that way in the beginning of the film, and then when the reveal does come, you're like, okay, yeah, but, yeah, how stupid am I for not remembering that he should be the villain based on his introduction in the beginning?
Yeah.
That seems so funny, because they, like, drown out his audio. So he's just like trying to talk to Liam, and Neeson's just like, "Yeah, I'm not gonna like talk."
He's just like, "Yeah, he's just a cloying asshole." It's like, I'm really not paying attention to you.
And I somehow try to talk myself into the idea that the person texting him was going to be off the plane, but that's really not plausible in any sense. But that's just something I was like,
I thought that it was thinking be that. What I figured would happen. This is just my own personal theory. During the movie, I was like, he just watched all the passengers on those cameras. And so I was like, maybe there's someone on the ground who can see the cameras.
Yeah.
And is giving the impression that they're on the plane.
Mm-hmm.
And then he's going to have to, like, I wouldn't even know what would happen at that point. But
Dennis Hopper watching all the passengers come on.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to notice that one of the people just keeps getting called Wildcat.
Yeah.
It's like, my God. But yeah, good movie. Like I said, don't let my incredulity over the the madness of the twist make anyone feel like this isn't a worthy thing to go see, because it is. But just like it was set, and it was like there was, first of all, Danny, you described the opening of this movie perfectly. You also forgot, however, that he's listening to some kind of talk radio show, and they are specifically talking about air marshals.
Yeah,
I'm like, is this something people care about? Like the person was like, the expense of the air marshal program, and they're just sitting in first class and blah blah blah. And I was like, is that like, are people upset about that? Because I feel like I hear a lot of crazy conservative cost cutting things, and I've never heard anyone say, let's get rid of the air marshals.
Well, didn't you also find it so funny how they relay his entire life story on that news broadcast?
Yeah.
Like, oh, yeah.
He was so born funny. In Ireland and moved to New York in 1991.
Oh, my God. I was so happy about that, because usually no one ever brings up the fact that he clearly has an Irish accent in these fucking movies. So, like, in Taken, it's just like, oh, I'm with the CIA. And it's like, you're fucking Irish. What is happening here? And then, yeah, so in this one, they're like, he was born in Ireland. I was like, oh, sweet. All right. I guess that's a point for the movie. But it was weird, because I don't feel like they do that usually. And then, I guess, you know, talking about insane speeches, I actually really liked his speech, even though it did have a little bit of a winking quality. Because he was like, you know, my daughter had, like, infant leukemia, and I worked every day because I couldn't stand to see her die, and, like, I drank too much, and I lost my family, and blah, blah, blah. He's like, I'm not a good man, but I'm going to save this plane. I was like, that's the best character motivation ever. I just love his single-mindedness. And I think that one of the things that really sells Liam Neeson, despite his age, as an action star, is that he really does seem like the type of person who would just go out of his way to do something because it's the right thing to do. And I don't know if that's his voice, I don't know if it's his face, I don't know if it's because he played Oscar Schindler, but when he says, I don't care about anything, I'm a terrible human being, but I'm gonna save this plane, I was like, you're goddamn right you are, Liam Neeson.
He just cares, man.
He just cares so much.
Yeah.
Ah, fucking great. Anyway, so that's our review of Nonstop. It's out in theaters now. Check it out. So let's move on. Let's talk about what's coming to Blu-ray and theaters this week. So coming to Blu-ray, we got 12 Years a Slave, which is, if you all remember, my favorite film of the year.
Was anybody surprised that Peter Nyong'o wasn't, like, whipped in Nonstop?
Shit, dude.
Jesus.
Wow. Do you want me to cut that out?
Do whatever you want. Okay. I leave it in your hands.
I was surprised. Okay, so here.
You were surprised she wasn't being whipped.
No, right? I was surprised that she didn't have more of a thing, because I thought, oh, it's her from 12 Years a Slave. That's awesome. They're obviously going to do something with her. Nope. She had like two lines.
Yeah. So no, that was very strange.
It was very strange. Very strange indeed. So anyway, 12 Years a Slave. That's coming out. That's a new one. Also, The Grandmaster. Also, Old Boy.
Well, the Grandmaster already came out.
Why is it? Is it like getting a re-release?
Yeah. Well, let me look here. Let me open the. We're right on top of things.
Open the old browser.
Maybe it's weird that, well, that would have to be like a reissue, which is weird because it just came out. But yeah, unless they're finally releasing the wonderful Chinese cut on U.S. home video, but that doesn't appear to be the case. So, fuck off, Army.
Oh, we never said that Snowpiercer's getting a full release without getting cut.
And now we have.
Yeah, so now we did. That doesn't have anything to do with this, though. Old Boy is also coming to Blu-ray.
Yeah!
Yeah, Old Boy. Spike Lee's Old Boy. Interesting film. We talked about that. Last Days on Mars, another new release, as well as Philomena. Has anyone seen that movie?
I have not.
No?
Yeah.
Ty, you're like the one person here who I would expect to have seen Philomena.
Now, why is that?
I don't know. It seems like something you'd see for your morning show or whatever.
That's a morning movie.
Who watches the morning news? Old white people. Who would go see Philomena? Old white people.
It all adds up.
I alluded that one somehow, but yeah, you were on point though. It almost happened.
Okay.
Oh, okay. Excellent. All right.
Yeah.
All right.
Looks like Intolerable Cruelty.
I was going to say, there are a couple of reissues, re-releases, Intolerable Cruelty, An American Tale, Fried Green Tomatoes. boiler room, which is amazing. And yeah, so any of these really knocking anyone's socks off? Obviously, 12 Years a Slave for me.
Are you gonna like buy that?
Yeah, or? I'm gonna buy the shit out of that.
Okay. I have never seen The Agony and the Ecstasy, but I'm kind of curious, especially after I went to the Vatican and some members of my party, all they did was make Agony and the Ecstasy jokes, like when you're in the Sistine Chapel. So there's that. There's also this a film called The Visitor, which is from 1979.
Yeah.
And it was recently sort of remastered and re-released by Draft House Films. It's supposed to be kind of an uber bizarre cult classic. So you can count me intrigued about that. That's something. And Spike Lee's Old Boy, I like a lot. It's a really entertaining, very propulsive revenge thriller. And I don't know. I don't know if it's going to be like rediscovered or something. Probably not.
I want you to do a revival for that film in like five years.
Yeah, I've joked I should actually do the Jesse James revival equivalent of Spike. Just go around the country showing people this film. It is too bad that I guess the original cut of the movie was like 2 hours and 20 minutes or something. It seems like we'll probably never see that, but yeah, still the theatrical version is a value. So, okay.
Well, good times. And then coming to theaters March 7th, we have The Grand Budapest Hotel, newest film by Wes Anderson, which I haven't read any reviews, and I haven't even really tried to look at any of the titles of any reviews, but apparently it's great, so I'm looking forward to that.
The new film by Wes Anderson, correct?
Yes, the new Anderson.
Yes.
You can look for my review that might actually be up by the time this episode airs.
What grade? I'm not going to read the review, just tell me like what grade you gave it.
Do you really want to know what grade I'll give it?
I kind of, yeah, but I was kidding.
Okay.
About not reading
it. You can just tell us next week.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's always about you, Nick.
Yes.
We also have 300, Rise of an Empire, and Mr. Peabody and Sherman.
Oh, one new release, Grand Piano.
Wasn't that on VOD for a while?
It still is.
Yeah. It might still be there. So I watched that like the day after nonstop, and it was so weird how similar their premises are. So like Elijah Wood.
So it's like nonstop on a piano.
It's nonstop in an auditorium, basically. He's like playing piano, and then all of a sudden there's writing on his sheet music in red.
Oh my god, that is brilliant.
And it literally says, if you play one wrong note, you'll die. And so he's flipping through this writing on his sheet music, and I'm like, these are just like the texts nonstop. And he's the guy's like, you know, I'm gonna kill people in this public place, you know, whatever. Like, read my messages.
I would flip the fuck out if at the end of that movie, so like, I haven't seen it, so this is not a spoiler, I presume. But if at the end of that movie, he finishes, doesn't play a single wrong note, everyone gets on their feet and is cheering, and then he goes up to like the theater manager who like wants to book him for another showing because he's so perfect that they sold out, and he's like, I don't understand, like, how are you able to play so perfectly? And then Elijah Wood's just like, I have my ways. And then it shows him that night just getting drunk off his ass and writing his own threats on his sheet music so that they're like a surprise to him the next day.
That would be a shocking ending.
Yeah. Anyway, that's just...
But yeah, definitely not the one that's in the motion picture.
Okay. Well, anyway, we'll be talking about The Grand Budapest Hotel next week. Is anyone excited at all for 300 Rise of an Empire? Or is this like 10 years too late?
Yeah, I'm dreading having to see it.
I've heard Eva Green is incredible in it, though.
Well, that's good. That's good. At least that's something.
Well, that's good. I don't even know. So this is 300, Rise of an Empire. Is that, like, what, is this a prequel or a sequel?
It's actually, okay, so from what I understand, it jumps, like, 10 years ahead. It starts, like, 10 years after the events, and then it goes back to take place. In a flashback, it takes place at, like, the same time. Yeah, it seems really overly complicated for the sequel to 300, a movie I like very much.
Yeah, I liked 300.
From what I understand, this kind of, from what I've been told, this kind of continues the what I take is the very sort of self-aware quality of the first movie, and just runs with it. So maybe maybe that's good. But yeah, I guess there's like a concurrent battle or something. So there's that. And then also, yeah, so I guess also there might even be something like 10 years before the events of 300 too in this movie. It's a very, it's sort of like, it's like an Alain René 300 movie.
Interesting.
Jumping through time. Yeah. No.
Perfect.
No.
Okay. And then does anyone care about Mr. Peabody and Sherman?
I am not actually 6 years old, so no.
I remember that played with Rocky and Bullwinkle, right? Like that was what, I think that was where it was in there.
Perhaps.
Anyway, I remember hating it as a kid, and it was like my least favorite part of whatever cartoon show it was part of. And I haven't heard anyone speak its name in like 15 years, and yet here it is. So, not entirely sure what's going on here. I will say that from all of the advertisements I've seen for it on Hulu, the animation looks atrocious. So, take that for what it may be. And that's that. So, let's talk about something that we watched on our own. And then we can get out of here. It's Thailandis. What is a movie that you watched on your own that you think we should check out?
Give me one sec. Okay, let's see here. Well, okay. It's probably too early to talk about Enemy, correct? Yeah.
I can't wait.
Oh, to no, talk. Dude, talk about Enemy.
Yes, talk about Enemy. Is it Enemy good?
Yeah, so it is good. But I went through this whole, because it was on demand and it was at a price that I felt comfortable paying, because I would have had to have driven an hour to see it, so I think
Jesus.
That all equaled out. But yeah, it ended up playing like on my TV screen for like a week straight, and so I watched it twice. It's really good. It's really trippy. It's Villa, how do you say it? Villa Denis Villeneuve. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I think that's how
finally having fun with himself for once, which is great to see. And people keep talking about sort of like the last shot or the penultimate shot in the film, which is great and everything. That's a total shock, but it's seeing Villeneuve have fun and being playful and sort of this sort of allegory in terms of a male insecurity in this film. And Gyllenhaal, this might be his best performance. This sort of playing the shade of duality with these guys. I don't want to reveal too much, obviously, but it's really fun. It's a great B movie and it's really fun, and just people will. It's going to be fun to see discussion about it. I don't think the film takes itself too seriously. I know there will be a lot of theorizing about it, but it's really great. And I don't want to give too much away, as I just alluded to. But pretty soon, another couple weeks until people finally see that, right? So
yeah.
So yeah,
I'm
definitely
really looking forward to that.
Definitely something to look forward to for sure.
Excellent. All right, Nick Newman, what about yourself?
Okay, so yeah, I saw a number of worthy films in the past week. I think the one I would most care to highlight is a film called The Face You Deserve, which is a 2004 Portuguese film by Miguel Gomez, who has kind of emerged in recent years as a big voice in the world cinema scene. He made the film Taboo, which premiered in 2012 and which was a huge hit. I know Danny was a big fan of it, right?
Yeah, that's unfortunately the only film of his that I've seen. But
and you also interviewed him. You also interviewed
him,
correct?
Yeah.
Right. So, so Gomez has kind of been on the up and up recently. And his first film from 2004, it was the only thing of his I'd seen so far, and I was really, really taken with it, despite kind of finding it delightfully obtuse. It's split into two parts. The two parts are titled Theater and Measles. As in the illness one can acquire. And both are sort of about, although there might seem to be kind of an incongruity between the two, both are about, I suppose, community and the way those communities can break down under certain circumstances, and kind of the horror that comes with putting your dependence on another human being. And to be honest, that's initially, I only saw it last night, and that's some of the most I can make of it immediately, because it's such a again, delightfully obtuse. The first half is sort of a musical, and the second half actually kind of plays like a really terrifying psychological thriller. But both are kind of funny too, and have this strange sense of whimsy to them. I kind of wonder, you know, if it's a film that people will actually be able to see at any point soon. Maybe as Gomez continues to ascend, he's actually shooting a year over the next year. He'll be shooting a version of Arabian Nights, I believe, which sounds like a really ambitious, crazy project. I imagine that'll get some attention. Hopefully his earlier work will as well. Actually, right here from Netflix, I have the DVD of his second feature, Our Beloved Month of August, which I'll be watching today, which I'm quite anticipating. The Face You Deserve. I don't know how many people, I don't know if anybody listening to the show has seen it, but, seek it out however you can, because it's quite strong.
All right. Danny King.
Very nice recommendations there by the two gentlemen. Gotcha. In addition to Renee, we also had another tough passing this week in Harold Ramis. And so a lot of people were talking about his comedies when they were sort of writing about him.
Yeah.
And one film that a lot of people were sticking up for that is very funny but not necessarily typical Ramis is his 2005 film, The Ice Harvest, which I was very pleased to see was streaming on Netflix. So I watched that. And it's very good. It's like... it sort of feels like Blood Simple with a bit more of Ramis's kind of wit in the dialogue. And it's also, it's set in Wichita, but it was shot in Chicago where Ramis is from. So it's like there's a lot of really good small town detail. And there's like a funny joke in the film because Connie Nielsen plays like the femme fatale. And she's just this like stunning woman in Wichita, and like, John Cusack asks her, like, what the hell are you doing in Wichita? Where are you from? And she's like, yeah, long fucking way from Wichita is where I'm from. And so there's, like, a lot of jokes throughout the film about, like, because it starts with them having just robbed, like, $2 million from their mob boss or whatever. So, like, the whole film takes place in the aftermath of the crime, and they're waiting to leave town. So there's a lot of just humor about them like wanting to get out but like failing at it. And Randy Quaid has a pretty good like third act appearance that kind of reminds me of William Hurt in A History of Violence, because he's kind of like mentioned throughout the film, but he never shows up until like those final 10 minutes, and he has a few good moments there. So I would recommend checking that one out.
All right. Well, I also have a film that was directed by Harold Ramis. It's been a bad week for film. So I watched the seminal feature Groundhog Day, a movie that, in keeping with its subject matter, I could watch over and over and over again. Anyone who hasn't seen Groundhog Day is an enemy of mine. And... it's just a fantastically funny, just interesting, fucking great movie. And it's hilarious every time I see it. And, it's one of those films that I think a lot of people don't give its full due credit to. Outside of the film people that I know, because everyone seems to love it. Bill Murray driving with a groundhog. I don't know. I feel it's one of those movies that feels so essential that I don't know that I really have to say much about it. I own this on DVD. I'm not sure if it's streaming anywhere, but you should all own it already too, because it's great. So I don't know what to do with you. So Groundhog Day: a man stuck reliving the same goddamn day over and over and over again. Great work by everyone involved. Clever script, interesting idea, and it's the idea that apparently is getting lifted and applied to a futuristic sci-fi war film called Edge of Tomorrow. So that's going to be interesting.
Oh, yeah, I got that trailer.
Yeah, you got it before Nonstop?
Yeah, I couldn't tell what was going on in the trailer.
It seems like it's a mashup of, I guess, like, Groundhog Day, which is also, like, Source Code, and I don't even fucking know. So we'll see how that goes. I'm sure we'll talk about that. But that's all for today, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining us for our talk about Nonstop. And yeah, let's just tell the people where we can be found, and then we can get out of here. So, Ty Landis, where can people find you online?
You can find me, as you mentioned earlier, at Interview Online and Movie Mezzanine. Also, I host the podcast at Sound On Sight called Almost Art House, and you could follow me on Twitter at Ty_Landis.
Danny King.
Certainly at thefilmstage.com, the website, thekingbulletin.com, and twitter.com/thekingbulletin.
Thekingbulletin.com, also a website.
If you say so.
Okay.
I did not make that distinction.
Nick Newman.
Yes, thefilmstage.com, twitter.com/Nick_Newman, and dead in the plane's bathroom.
Jesus.
Well, did they ever get him out? It seems like he was just kind of in there. And like when the plane crashes, also, what do you do when you find this dead body? Do you just lie and say, yeah, he just broke his neck in the bathroom?
That's what I'm saying. He's like walking around with just like a blanket on him at the end, flirting with Julianne Moore. It's like, you fucking murdered a guy. Like, there's not, you don't have to go to like a shooting thing. Like, they have like shooting boards, like when you're a cop. So, like, do they have neck snap boards when you're Liam Neeson?
I think so.
Okay.
It's whatevs.
It's whatevs. Oh, God. Just blank check. I mean, Shea Whigham at the end was basically like, hey, you want to keep that $150 million?
Yeah, dude, that was another, like, character actor reveal where I was like,
why is she
like, show him in the movie, like, you know? Like,
it was so weird that they, like, just gave him a face for that part.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway. It's his year. It's his year.
It's true. He's been in True Detective and
Wolf Wall Street.
I was almost 100% certain that could, because we never saw who was talking on the phone, I was almost certain that was going to be another reveal.
Yeah.
That was like, ah, it's me. Anyway.
It was McNary
doing his Shea Whigham impression. And he busts out at other parties for people whose names you don't know, but who you know you've seen in something else.
Our air marshals have awful voice recognition.
Anyway, I can be found online at thefilmstage.com, also my personal site, dearfilm.net, and on Twitter at twitter.com/BrianJRowan. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you once again. Tune in next week when we'll be talking about the Grand Budapest Hotel.